The mountains are brimming with endless possibilities for exploration, recreation, and knowledge generation. That knowledge can come from many places, from the animals that call the mountains home to the people that live with them. It can also come from the risks that are inherent with living and traveling in the mountains. That's one of the reasons why I joined this podcast, to learn more about different mountain regions and how people live in them. Today, I'll deliver that information right to your ears. I'm Ethan Ward, and you're listening to the Canadian Mountain Podcast. In this episode, we'll talk about the Mountain Risk Knowledge Exchange Program, which was designed to integrate citizen and community science into monitoring mountain hazards. This is done to better understand those hazards and protect people living in the mountains. But before we begin, I'd like to take a moment to appreciate the land that we work on and the people we work with. The Canadian Mountain Podcast acknowledges that our conversations engage with diverse knowledge holders who live and work on unceded and treated lands. We also recognize the historical and ongoing oppression that many Indigenous cultures, lands, and nations have continuously faced within Canada. This podcast actively seeks to decolonize, change, and inspire media platforms by including Indigenous ways of knowing. Many alpine nations from around the world have robust and well-developed risk monitoring systems in their mountains. Canada, however, is lagging behind other nations in many respects when it comes to monitoring these mountainous regions. This is due to a number of factors like the size of our country and population density. These factors are addressed by the Mountain Risk Exchange Program, led by Principal Investigator Glenn Williams-Jones from Simon Fraser University. His team works with communities towards building resilience and risk-aware approaches to mountain risks. In this episode of the Canadian Mountain Podcast, I spoke with two individuals who make up part of the Mountain Risk Knowledge Exchange Project. Our first guest is the principal investigator of the project, Dr. Glenn Williams-Jones.
I'm Glenn Williams-Jones. I'm a professor in the Department of Earth Sciences. Research-wise, I study active volcanoes most of the time, but I tend to go a bit more broad and look at a range of different natural hazards. I live here in the lower mainland of BC. Grew up in Montreal, but living in Port Moody, nearby Burnaby, where SFU is, so nice, beautiful part of the country.
Our second guest is Juan Anzieta, a PhD student from Simon Fraser University who works alongside Glenn on this project.
Hi, my name is Juan Anzieta. I am Glenn's student at Simon Fraser University. I come from Ecuador, but I am currently living in Canada. I live specifically at Burnaby in BC, where besides studying, I usually go for long walks and do my everyday life.
I met up virtually with Glenn and Juan to discuss the Mountain Risk Knowledge Exchange Project, where we delve into mountain hazards and how they impact people around them.
Can you tell us what the Mountain Risk Knowledge Exchange Project actually is?
The Mountain Risk Knowledge Exchange really sort of centered around a vehicle, a mechanism to bring together information, to share that information with the broadest sort of number of people in different areas, and to make it really a co-production. So the idea is, you know, an open access knowledge portal, a data portal, that people can contribute information, observations, and then learn from that that environment. And so part of the core to the exercise and the research that we're doing is to bring in community members, citizen scientists, to contribute their knowledge and also to learn from this. So a one-stop shop of information, data, knowledge related to mountains. And in fact, this has now grown into a larger entity and really focused around natural hazards. We're in a mountainous part of the world. It's a very dynamic setting, and you know, one of the situations we know in Canada, it's a large country, there's big open areas. And so I really think the strength of this project is trying to bring together people to be part of making this, sharing this knowledge. And there's so much knowledge that people have developed and passed down through the generations. So we want to take advantage of that and learn about this dynamic setting that we live in.
One, you mentioned that you're a Glynn student at Simon Fraser University. What involvement, if any, have you had with Mountain Risk Knowledge Exchange? And if you haven't, or even if you have, what has your involvement been with studying mountain risks in general?
Well, I believe that in general, it's about learning what can happen around mountains, because sometimes you can expect things to happen, and sometimes they just happen in a very unexpected manner. So in that sense, the Mountain Risk Knowledge Exchange has been, is, as Glynn said, a resource, is a one-stop goal, let's say, for feeding ourselves with knowledge and trying to learn, besides just simple terminology, what can happen. That's like the core of the matter.
Thank you. So building off that, I want to ask you guys, and both of you can answer this or take turns answering, can you explain for the audience who might be unaware of what they are, just what are mountain risks and how, what do they look like? How can they manifest in the mountains? Just very basic, what is or what are mountain risks?
So I can jump in here. You know, mountains are obviously, you know, these major features that we see around us, especially here in Western Canada, and they're dynamic. And so they interact with the atmosphere, and those big mountains have unfortunately a tendency to fall down because we have gravity. So there's this interplay between weather and gravity and these mountains that are changing over human to geologic timescales. So some of the issues that we deal with are things like large landslide events, huge volumes of rock failing catastrophically, or very small localized rain-induced flows of mud and debris. And that's just on the geological side of things. The mountain hazards also involve things that we're unfortunately in Canada becoming more and more familiar with, large forest fires and wildfire events. And these start to have an interplay, especially with changing climate. These are impacting people because we live in mountainous areas, and some of these events, as Juan mentioned, can happen in a very unpredictable way. So they're dynamic, they can be small, they can be very, very large, and they're extraordinarily difficult to predict. And so we actually use the term more forecast of those events. And so one of the things that Juan is doing is working on using different technology and different digital tools to try to understand how these features, a large debris flow, how it flows, where's it going, and hopefully can we have an alarm to, you know, mitigate the, reduce the impact of these events that we can't predict.
I could also add a little bit that these are the dangers that people may face by being at the mountains, but also near mountains. So for instance, if something happens and then there's like a damming of water around because of landslide or something, that dam could just break and then there's a flood coming by. So as Glynn said, these are cascading effects that basically can affect people even that are not located at the mountains themselves, but still suffer from the hazards that come out.
So this is another question for both of you. Does climate change make the mountains a riskier place to be in? And yeah, just does climate change have any effect on mountain risks at all?
Absolutely. And we've seen this very recently over the last fall and into the spring, these huge atmospheric rivers, these intense weather events bringing huge volumes of water, hitting those mountains and dumping in a very, very rapid, you know, quick, intense event, and that impacts those mountains. So the soil is unable to absorb that intense rainfall, and it's going to flow, it's going to fail. And so these environments are becoming riskier. And in a human setting, we have always growing populations, so there's a greater exposure to those risks. The problem, of course, is, as Juan mentioned, there's this cascading effect. We have multiple broader, maybe initially unconnected things like heavy rainfall and drought and wildfire conditions. Those all end up changing the soil, the various features of the mountains, and often making it matters much, much worse. So it's definitely becoming a problem. And as population continues to grow, there's a greater exposure to those hazards.
Yeah, as Glenn said, the problem is that as the climate change affects the weather even more, the more intense the weather gets, that tends to make things worse, right? If it's because more extreme weather usually means like more extreme hazards coming from that weather, right? But also, it's not only about the intensity, it's also about the temporal cycles that are affected. And you don't even need at some point larger intensities, just continuous rain powering, for instance, can feed the water systems and then saturate the soil. And then if the soil changes, then landslides can occur, and it's changing in all aspects, right? In timing and intensity.
Juan, you touched on this earlier. I don't know if you can go any more in depth in it, but how do these mountain risks affect people in and outside the mountains?
As I mentioned, yes, for people in the mountains, it is pretty straightforward. If a hazard such as a landslide happens to occur where they live, they will be, of course, directly affected depending on the magnitude of the events. And this can lead to the destruction of private property or even public property. For people outside mountains, even if the event is not so large, still the damage, even if it's indirect, it can be harmful. For example, if just one road is affected, then traveling through that road or the supply of goods that come from that road is disrupted, and it still affects the person, even if the hazard itself does not reach them. So it's a problem that really concerns everyone at some point.
So what you just described, that is stuff we have been seeing very recently. I believe it was in last November in BC, there was, you know, major landslides all throughout southern British Columbia, and it impacted, you know, the supply chain and everything that you just described. Yes. So, Juan, if you want to go into this a bit more, is there a way that those mountain risks, is there a way that they could have been avoided or prevented, or at least the damage mitigated?
I mean, yes, these events are very hard to avoid. It's when nature does things that are large in scale, we can barely face those scales. They go beyond what we can do directly. For instance, in China, where they have a heavy monitoring of the mountain hazards for a long time, they still suffer deep consequences from landslides and flash floods. So I think that prevention is the more important task, and it's easier than stopping the events. And the first step is to study these hazards. Try to at least get a feel on how they happen, when they occur. But it also requires active participation, collaboration, and predisposition from all the people that is involved, not just universities, but also authorities and communities and everyone.
And Glenn, I'll move to you now. How is the Mountain Risk Knowledge Exchange project, how is this project going to mitigate problems connected to mountain risks, or how is it seeking to do that?
Actually, Juan touched on that. It's a really important part. We want the science, the engineering, the technology to try to collect the data, so new instruments deployed more broadly, new digital tools to understand and manipulate all of the data that we start to get. But simultaneously, it's got to be that engagement with the communities, helping to teach and to learn from the communities, that we will then work towards being able to mitigate the impact. So one of the other members in our team is working on a natural hazards communication project, and she's been doing surveys to try to understand how prepared communities are for different natural hazards, especially in the mountains here in British Columbia. And one of the interesting things that's come out is they're very well prepared, but there's things that could be done better. The government could do a better job in communicating the risks and some of, say, the supports that are available when people are displaced because of a large, intense rainfall leading to a landslide. So it's as much new data, new science, as well as the education and the engagement with communities. Then it's a team effort. And so certainly in order to mitigate an event, one of the issues is, you know, trying to get people out of the way. And getting people out of the way requires that those people believe and understand why they're being forced to do this incredibly difficult decision of leaving their homes. And so I think this is the power of this type of a project, is it's both the community engagement, the communications, and the hard fundamental science.
To kind of follow up on what you talked about, one of the objectives of this project is to develop new approaches to mountain risk management to change what has been done so far. So what are some of these new approaches? I know you just mentioned a couple of them, but maybe if you could go more in depth or explain them a bit more as well, that would be awesome.
Well, I think broadly, actually, it's trying, rather than taking the older top-down approach, entity X, government agency Y says, thou must do this because we know the best for you. We've been trying to work from the bottom up and identify those priorities for the community, because the communities are, and each community is different. They face different challenges within the mountains. And it's, maybe it's the size of the community, or it's the remoteness of the community, it's access to different infrastructure. So I think in terms of a management of how do we reduce the impact of these events, it's going in and listening to the community members, engaging with them, having that dialogue and discussion, learn from them, but also try to say, well, here are some opportunities, some ways to teach the kids how to deal with things, what they can do to change things in the future through, via small actions. And so that's where I think there is a difference in approach. It's get down, go and look at that place and understand why is that place important and how is it different from another area. And from that, then we're going to be able to do, I would hope, a more targeted, more relevant project, study, and ideally come up with useful approaches that will work rather than a one size fits all.
So this next question is for both of you. What are some of the challenges that the project has faced so far?
I think that for me, as the guy that usually goes to the field and tries to install things or collect some data, I think that, of course, the first challenge is, as Glenn mentioned before, the distances, right? The large scales. It's hard getting to some places. It's long trips, and it can be challenging if it has to be done super frequently, because it requires lots of logistics. So that's why it's important to have long-term projects going on.
And I would add, obviously, there's this whole umbrella that we've all been working on of COVID. And that has unfortunately really limited the engagement aspect. We've been fortunate in still being able to get out into the field in some areas, but part of that, the workshops and the larger, broader community engagement was forced to be done virtually. And we all know that that's just never as effective as a real face-to-face sit down and you know, meeting with people. So that's certainly been another challenge for the broader project. But I think we've all done our best and we've overcome a lot of these hurdles. The graduate students like Juan, had a whole lot of this stuff thrown at them very, very quickly, and we've had to respond. And so, I think without tooting our own horns, I think we've done a really good job of pivoting and adapting to this, but it could have been a lot easier.
How are indigenous groups and individuals getting involved with this project? You know, that definitely kind of fits into the community aspect of the project that you've mentioned so far.
So, I mean, it's been key. They've been key partners right from the get-go. Again, COVID has just complicated that engagement because of the limited access and the inability over the first few years to really have some face-to-face discussions. But inevitably, especially in the Sea to Sky corridor, but also we have other projects in the High Arctic, the work and the research is being carried out on the traditional territories of the indigenous members of the broader community. So it's engagement. It's we've been going through the normal procedures for permitting and access, but also trying where possible to at least have online discussions and presentations about the research that's being carried on. It could have been more effective if we hadn't had to deal with the remote nature of things. But I would also suggest that thanks to this project, it's actually given us a stepping stone to open up other projects that are ongoing, some recent ones that are developing with the Squamish Nation and the Lillooet Nation, so in Squamish and in Pemberton, around some of the mountains in the area. So that it certainly helped us launch into some other parallel projects.
To complete a little bit on what Glenn just said, since right now, because of the restrictions that we had and all these constraints, since we are still in some sense, at least in terms of data acquisition, we are still in some of the installation phase. But what is worth mentioning is that the data is not only going to be shared with all the communities involved, because it's going to be open access data, but also we are going to try to socialize what the data means and try to explain what is the purpose and what do we expect from this data. So that we all can work together into understanding and using the data and then eventually mitigating the effects of hazards.
I think another avenue, and it's sort of, a bit of a follow-up, is this, and again, this is something I'd hoped we would have been able to make greater traction, but there's a wealth of information recorded in the stories of the local indigenous communities. And that wealth of information, often recorded through oral traditions, is as yet, I think, it hasn't, in the broader scientific community, it really hasn't been recognized for its real value, its real importance in understanding these very complicated processes. And so that is an area that our group, we've been working with, not in this area, but in northwest of Terrace, where we showed really the incredible benefits of working in the and through collaboration, the indigenous histories. And in this case, it was related to some volcanic events. But that information really can give us insights on how frequent these events, what style of events that have occurred in the past and how they might occur in the future. So I think that is an area that still needs to develop further in a really meaningful way.
To expand upon what was just said and what we just talked about, how is the project incorporating or using the knowledge that the indigenous groups are bringing to the exchange?
It is about trying to put some history to these events. So, for example, this one mountain that we've been working on as a group, Mount Meager, northwest of Pemberton, is it's a large, unstable mountain. It's also an active volcano. And so this is an area that needs further work, but the hope is to bring in some of the oral traditions that recount some of the earlier, as yet unstudied, events of this volcano, and also, you know, some of the landslide events that have occurred. And so that historic information can then help us better target areas for focused research, say, for example, you know, being able to put some more detailed dating on some events, and others, say, on a hazards perspective, trying to say, well, where are there the good ways to better understand the impact of these events? Currently, right now, we're in discussion finalizing a research agreement with the Squamish Nation, looking at a mountain in Squamish, the Stawamish Chief. And so we'll be installing a small seismometer called a Raspberry Shake, a citizen science tool, in their totem hall, and they're partnering with SFU in the data collection, but also working with members of the nation, identifying areas on the Stawamish Chief that are culturally sensitive. And so understanding what aspects, what avenues can we move forward on, and say, installing instrumentation on the mountain, and where it's not appropriate. So that cultural knowledge and that respectful partnering, I think, is really key. But again, this is still something that I think we're only just starting to move forward on. It's definitely an area that needs to be expanded. And I hope that as we move forward, that engagement will increase.
So Juan, this next question is for you, and Glenn, you can feel free to jump in as well. But how is community collaboration and citizen science being incorporated into the exchange project? You guys have brought up so far a lot about getting involved, or getting the community involved in community engagement, and just citizen science in general. So yeah, how are they getting involved with the exchange project, and what's happening in with that area of the project?
I think that it's important to share everything as it is, because transparency is a principle that is much needed in our current world, in the situation where institutions are continuously being criticized or under some public scrutiny. So I think that relations where everything is open and visible strengthen the actions that can be taken from those relations.
And, you know, as a follow-on, you know, some of the things that we're working towards, we've already got one instrument, one of these small citizen science seismometers installed near Squamish in Britannia, in it's a sort of a little miniature conference center. And, you know, they've provided us access to that space and power. We're hoping within the next month to install a few more of these sensors in schools in the Squamish area. And so there's the opportunity both for students to be engaged at various levels in their curriculum, you know, I would see from K to 12, where the students can see, yes, this is the seismometer, and we're listening to the rockfalls, and we're seeing them happen. The other community members that we haven't touched on, but I think are also really important, is the private sector. So some of the monitoring that we've been doing on Mount Meager is very much thanks to donations from the private sector. So we've had partners provide for free really powerful camera and satellite telemetry systems that we now have installed, and support from local other private sectors, using, you know, access to the mountain, logistical support. And they're doing that because they're good corporate citizens. They're engaged. They want to be part of the solution. And it's not because they're forced to, it's because they're choosing to do this because they're members of society. So I think this is one of the things we're trying to do, is also bring in universities, schools, private sector partners, government agencies of different levels together to try to deal with these really complicated, difficult situations. And again, as an academic, it's far more entertaining. It's more fun to be working in a multidisciplinary team because we're going to learn more.
So, Glenn, this question is for you. In the project description, it notes that Canada is one of the few nations that hasn't really implemented a risk monitoring system. So what has the Mountain Risk Knowledge Exchange Project learned from other communities from around the world or within Canada about mountain risk management?
Fundamentally, it gets down to we need more information. We need more data. And you know, Juan is from a very mountainous country, Ecuador. And in Ecuador, there has been a very proactive approach to installing monitoring. Many of these mountains are active volcanoes in proximity to population centers. So there's been that push to monitor, to better study you know, those mountains. Here in Canada, part of the problem is that some of it's geopolitical, but you know, we're in Western Canada, the mountains are far from Ontario, it's, you know, why should we worry? But I think some of the things that we're learning are we need to be studying these systems. We need to be understanding the complex interplay between biology, geology, and humanity. And that takes more and more information because it's complicated. But it's not easy to do in Canada. We've got a very big country, very small population per, you know, per square kilometer, but that population is increasing, and unfortunately it's increasing in areas where we have these increasing hazards because of the changing climate. So some of the things that we can learn are very much engage, get more information, and as Juan said, share that information in an open fashion so that the population are part of the solution. And you know, they're going to respond more appropriately if they're part of, they feel that they are involved. It's not a top-down, it's a grassroots, bottom-up approach.
Juan, turning to you for this next question. Glenn already, he mentioned the, you know, the geopolitical and also the population problems that are associated with mountain risk management in Canada and why it hasn't developed as much. Is there any other reasons in your mind why Canada is behind in developing risk management systems in the mountains?
I think that there's another problem, and it's on the side of the continuity of projects and initiatives, because sometimes the risk and hazard assessments are only important when the hazard occurs. So when the flood happened, everyone is excited or, well, worried about it, or when the fire comes and then everything is covered in smoke, everyone realizes, oh, should we have, like, preemptively done some controlled fire initiatives or something. But then after the hazard is passed, the governments and the people tend to forget about them or leave them a little bit like unattended. Or sometimes the studies that are performed only last for a moment, and then funding stops, and all the knowledge and all the actions that revolved around those studies and projects tend to stall. So basically, I think that the other problem on why there's not much development on the risk management systems is basically because there's no continuity. So I think that continuity and long-term projects should be the focus or should be put into a higher priority?
So we talked about this this next question. We talked about, a lot about what it involves earlier in the interview when we were saying how mountain risks affect people in and out of the mountains. So this question is for both of you, and apologies if we're kind of covering a little bit of the same ground here. We might be, but why is it vital for the public to recognize the importance of mountain hazards?
I would say it's because they're getting worse. They're getting worse. They're becoming more intense. They're, again, because of the changing climatic situation that we're all facing, that we're all living through. And these events are more intense and less predictable. They're occurring during times when they wouldn't normally occur. And these are all impacting us. You know, one of the things we haven't really discussed to date, but it's this idea of, again, these cascading hazards. We have a large landslide. We can start impacting on things like, yes, our infrastructure, but also, say, our water supply. Fresh water, drinking water, is critical for all humans. And as part of this changing climatic system that we're dealing with, the glaciers are shrinking. The system is becoming less stable as a whole. And that's going to impact more and more people. Even not just those people, you know, as we've discussed, in the mountains, but more broadly. So, you know, I think it's really important that people are aware of their surroundings. We like to go out into the mountains. They're beautiful places. And especially after the last 2 years, it's really healthy for us to get out and enjoy what's around us. But unfortunately, it's also becoming a more dangerous place to play. So being aware and seeing, you know, your actions have impact, small changes in your actions can hopefully start to maybe reduce some of the problems and some of the hazards that we're facing in the mountains. And what we have here in Canada, what we learn here, I think can be applied to other countries in the world, other mountainous countries. But by that same token, we can also learn a lot from those other countries as well.
To add a little bit to what Glenn just said, I also think that it's important, it's vital for the public to recognize the importance of mountain hazards, because in the end, it is the people who make the final decision on how to act during this crisis, especially because sometimes external pressure like politics and so on can cause the opposite effects of what people want to do if it's done in an improper manner. So basically the smart thing to do is to learn about these hazards and also to teach how to assess the risks associated to these hazards, and that's why people needs to be the ones that recognize them and be able to respond to them in the end.
So we've come up on our final question, and to tie back into the citizen science and community engagement that we've talked about a lot so far, this question is for both of you. Is there anything people can do to help become part of the solution in mitigating mountain risks?
Absolutely. They are part of the solution by being engaged with projects like this. As I've said before, Canada is a big empty country, but we're also a very wealthy country, and we have people who, you know, have the wherewithal to go out and enjoy the country, enjoy the mountains, be part of that. And so some of the things that we're still working towards are developing things like small, apps that people can use to collect information. They saw something happen, a landslide in an area that no one had noticed. The government and the university, we don't have the resources to be out there everywhere. But if people are out in the field, in the mountains, enjoying it, taking up, making observations, being part of the citizen science contributors, I think is a really meaningful way to be part of that solution. Being willing to have a seismometer in your basement and share that information, or a small weather station on your roof that collects data in an area that otherwise doesn't have anything, all of that can help us move towards better understanding. And just being engaged, being an engaged citizen in our country, learning, being willing to ask questions. And I think that's going to make a difference.
That was Glenn Williams-Jones and Juan Anzieta, who both worked on the Mountain Risk Knowledge Exchange Program. They hope to provide practical guidance for communities who have to live with mountain risks based on the knowledge already gathered from mountain communities in Canada. Their goal is to address gaps in Canada's risk monitoring system. That's it for this edition of the Canadian Mountain Podcast, in partnership with Mount Royal University. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced from Treaty 7 Territories, a place that holds generations of culture and stories. With the Canadian Mountain Podcast, our goal is to share both Indigenous knowledge and settler perspectives. And we give appreciation to those stories. We are committed to collaborating with Indigenous peoples through storytelling and partnerships. Therefore, we acknowledge the hereditary keepers of these lands, the Niitsitapi, Îyâhe Nakoda, Tsuut'ina, and Métis peoples. I'm Ethan Ward, and special thanks to show producer Catalina Berguno. Be sure to join us again for more stories surrounding mountain places, whether that be in our own backyard or from around the country. Share and subscribe to get the latest updates on the new season, and be sure to tell your mountain-loving friends and colleagues. You can find us wherever you find your podcasts, and you can learn more about the Canadian Mountain Network at canadianmountainnetwork.ca.